Church's team at Christian Aid, and this is the fourth year we've been here to talk about what it is about our faith that inspires us to work for justice. Peter is the flamboyant, eye-catching half of the show. I'm the voice of restraint and helpful communication, and I'm sure we can agree I've cornered the market in good looks and style. I'm going to do my best to help you through the next hour, but unfortunately Peter's not going to be helping as he's opted to do his entire half of the seminar in rhyme.
And this is how it begins. The church discovered politics in 1999. It backed the Drop the Debt campaign, the first one of its kind.
Entirely typical. Flashy yes, witty yes. Accurate, not even close. Now, you may have discovered politics in 1999. I'm sure Peter discovered politics in 1999. For all I know, that's the first time that many people around Greenbelt discovered that having a Christian faith had a political edge. And we owe the Jubilee Debt Campaign a huge debt of gratitude for doing that. It was the first opportunity, I think, for masses of churches to come together and campaign in a public way. But to say that that was the first time that Christians were activists is ridiculous. Peter, if you're going to contribute anything to the talk, you're going to have to do better than that.
Okay. The church campaigned that blacks and whites had equal rights in law and helped apartheid to its end in 1994.
Which is really not getting any better. Because the whole point of this talk is to show that campaigning has been part of the Christian tradition for a long, long time, a long while before our generation. And if our collective memory only goes back 10 years, then every generation is going to have to rediscover that the Christian faith has something to say about politics. And every generation is going to have to discover that being a Christian and praying to God has more to do than trying to find a parking spot when you've decided to drive into town on the busiest shopping day of the year.
It all began in 1910, the first campaign of note, when Christians marched with suffragettes and women got the vote.
Please, don't encourage him. No, don't. Campaigning is not even a 20th century discovery for Christians. As long as there's been a history of Christians asking, how should we confront evil, then there have been organised attempts of finding ways of challenging and changing the powers of the day to make the world more like the world that Jesus had a vision for. And surely how do we confront evil is one of the most important questions for Christians at the start of the 21st century as well, unless you believe that the point of Jesus living, dying and rising again was to cure your rather persistent toothache.
And in the 18th century, the church campaigned, of course, the anti-slavery campaign of... They're with me. They're with me.
When he wrote this, I really didn't think he was going to do that well. I'm in danger of losing it now. I was going to come here with a perfectly serious and sensible message to get across about Christians being the prophetic voice of God and the challenge that God needs for the world today. And frankly, my will to live is draining away just at the moment.
Do you want me to do another one? Okay, right. The Reformation brought the biggest change the world have seen, and Christians rallied to the cause in 1517.
No, I've given up.
That's more like it. Good afternoon. My name's Peter Greystone, and now we've got this pantomime all to myself, we'll start again. There is, in fact, a Christian tradition of non-violent campaigning that stretches back to Jesus and way beyond into the Jewish tradition out of which Christianity rose. That puts Bono and Bob, who've become the voices that cheer Christian hearts as they seek justice for the world's poorest people, in a line that stretches back through history to Paul and Peter, James and John, the first disciples. And the reason that is significant is that if it turns out that political involvement has always been part of God's plan for announcing the kingdom of God, we might have to do some new thinking. Some of the events in the life of Jesus and the first church, as they're told in the Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles, might seem to have a different significance if they were taking place in the context of a crowd of believers who were used to being politically active. So now that we're out of farce mode and into serious business mode, the first question is it true that the Jews and Christians of the first century saw themselves as campaigners? Well, rather than reminding you of stories from the Gospels that you know, here is the story of something that happened at the time that Jesus was alive, shortly afterwards, in fact. And it's fascinating because it shows that the question, how do God's people respond to evil, isn't a new one by any means. The emperor in Rome, the military power that had conquered Judea and was oppressing its people, was Caligula. More than any other emperor, his name has come to be associated with violent evil. And as far as God's people were concerned, his most wicked act was to attempt to erect a statue of himself in the guise of the immortal god Zeus in the temple at Jerusalem. It forced people to choose, who is your god? Who will you worship? The emperor? Or the god your forefathers have worshipped since Abraham? Caligula, safe in his palace in Rome, decreed that this statue was to be built and sent his legate, a man called Petronius, to oversee its construction in the heart of the temple. Petronius made his way from Rome to Jerusalem, which was a substantial journey, and he took 12,000 soldiers with him, which suggests that he knew all along that there might be trouble. As his procession travelled, stopping for winter on the coast at Ptolemais, the Jews decided what they would do to oppose this great evil that was about to be inflicted on their world. They began a campaign. Tens of thousands of them, literally tens of thousands, gathered around Ptolemais in order to petition him not to do this evil thing. And the one thing that they were determined was this shouldn't, under any circumstances, be seen as an armed uprising. So they took their wives and children with them. Like the marches for peace, for debt cancellation, and for trade justice that we must all be aware of, this wasn't a war, it was a family outing. The Jews arranged deputations to go and see Petronius and took with them bundles of letters from others in the area in which he was staying to show the strength of feeling behind their petition. And they timed it very carefully. They made their move just before the time when the farmers among them, which was most of them, should have been sowing seeds in the fields, which fed not only them, but fed the Romans as well. They knew that if their campaign was not successful quickly, there would be no harvest that year. And Petronius knew that if there were no harvest that year, then there would be mass hunger. And nothing was more likely to make people rise up and overthrow their oppressors than having no food to give their children. Very targeted, very clever. This campaign for God's cause continued day after day. Petronius was not allowed to think of anything else, and it wore him down. Deeply impressed both by their character and their campaigning, finally he was persuaded by them. He announced that he now recognized the emperor's command to be unsustainable, and he could no longer support it. He wrote a letter to Caligula explaining what had happened and refusing to organize the building of his statue. Miles away in Rome, Caligula, who was slowly going insane, was incensed. He immediately composed a reply to Petronius, demanding that in view of this decision, he must kill himself before the sun set that evening. If he declined to do so, he would, of course, be murdered by the bearer of the message. Seething with rage, he sent a messenger to bear the letter to the doomed man. In Ptolemais, which is about 12 miles from Galilee, so it's not far at all from Jerusalem, Petronius and his entourage were fully expecting what Caligula's response would be. So it was no surprise to him when a messenger arrived bearing an imperial letter. Petronius opened it and read it. It said, "The Emperor Caligula is dead, all previous orders from him are null and void. The letter demanding that he kill himself arrived the next day. The messenger with the news of Caligula's death had overtaken it. The statue was never built. God's people, triumphant after their political campaign against evil, returned to their farms and sowed their crops. Petronius died peacefully in his old age.
Right, that's enough. You've had your turn while I sat down to scoff. I used the time to learn a rhyme, so you can bugger off. Good afternoon. My name's Nigel Vandel, and at this stage, I think I want to pose the interesting question, so what? So what if Petronius was the target of a well-orchestrated, non-violent campaign? What has that got to do with us? Well, potentially quite a lot. There's a real danger when we read the Bible that we try and interpret it to say not what it actually says, but what we want it to say, what we want to hear it say. We read back into the Bible the conclusions that we want to find there. It's an accusation that has been levelled at those people who describe the Bible as being political, or talk about Jesus as being a campaigner, or suggest that the Bible written thousands of years ago has anything to say about the way we exercise our democratic rights in the 21st century. Surely the argument goes, what people are doing is actually twisting the Bible to try and justify the conclusions that they've already come to. It's the kind of accusation as well that gets levelled against organisations like Christian Aid. How can we pretend that Jesus had anything to say about global trading agreements when he lived in first century Palestine? Or more importantly just now, how can we suggest that Jesus wants us to be political campaigners when there's no political campaigning in the Gospels? This is where Petronius comes in, but let's listen to a familiar passage from the Gospel of Luke, read to us by Rachel.
Jesus went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. As he approached Bethage and Bethany at the hill called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' tell him, 'The Lord needs it.' Those who were sent ahead went and found it, just as he had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, 'Why are you untying the colt?' They replied, 'The Lord needs it.' They brought it to Jesus, threw their cloaks on the colt, and put Jesus on it. As he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. When he came near the place where the road goes down the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen. 'Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest.' Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, 'Teacher, rebuke your disciples.' 'I tell you,' he replied, 'if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out.'"
The very familiar story of the triumphal entry. Here we have the public acknowledgement that Jesus was the Messiah, the growing realization of the disciples that the Jesus that they knew was the Messiah, and that fact has now been made public by the cheering of the crowds on the road to Jerusalem. This is the one chosen by God to set people free from their sins, to usher in an era when people and God will be reconciled to one another. This is the moment when salvation begins to seep into history. But hold on. What if that isn't the point? What if the triumphal entry is not a celebration of salvation, but a political protest? Why do I think that? Well, let's look at the story in a little bit more detail. At the time of the triumphal entry, the region of Judea around Jerusalem was under direct Roman control. Jesus had come from the north, from Galilee, where Herod Antipas ruled as a client king of the Romans. And he'd come south and entered a piece of land that was fully and directly controlled by a Roman prefect. And that Roman prefect from 26 to 36 was Pontius Pilate. Now, Pilate ruled from a town on the coast called Caesarea Maritima. He had his soldiers there, Roman auxiliaries, and they were stationed out there for most of the year. There was a small garrison of soldiers that stayed in the Antonine Fortress and the northwest corner of the temple in Jerusalem. They were there to kind of keep a lid on trouble. But during the Passover time, thousands and thousands of observant Jews flocked into Jerusalem to celebrate. Tensions ran high. There was an expectation that the Messiah would come at the time of Passover, and we have this political powder keg that's threatening to boil over and explode. So what did Pilate do? He did what any good governor would do. He takes his troops from the coast, and he marches them into Jerusalem to reinforce the garrison, to keep the lid on any trouble, on any tensions. So just before this is going on, Pontius Pilate marches into Jerusalem, flanked by Roman soldiers, sat on a horse, coming in from the west. At the same time, Jesus is coming into Jerusalem for Passover. He comes from Jericho via Bethany, comes up over the Mount of Olives, down past the Garden of Gethsemane, across the Kidron Valley, and in from the east. He comes in riding a colt from the other side. Jesus' triumphal entry is a parody of Pilate. One comes from the west with soldiers sitting on a horse. One comes from the east on a colt with people shouting for peace. Jesus appears to be making a political statement. You're either for God or you're for Rome. You're for him or you're for Pilate. You're for a kingdom where the blind see, the poor hear good news and the oppressed go free. Or you're for an empire where the poor are oppressed and marginalized, and a distant emperor rules the country through the political patronage of a rich elite. Now, there's an obvious retort to that that says, you're reading into the passage what you want it to say. It's anachronistic to think of Jesus as being a political campaigner. How do we know the Jews of the time ever thought of their actions that way? Well, that's where Petronius comes in. We do know that about that time there was a civil society in Palestine that was prepared to risk its lives in order to confront the power of Rome. At that time, in the person of Petronius. If we know that the Jewish people of the time were capable of thinking in terms of symbolic actions, in marches, in letter writing, and in petitions for political purposes, why do we insist on thinking Jesus doesn't do the same? Yes, the triumphal entry was about declaring Jesus to be a Messiah. But this is a Messiah with a political program outlined by its opposition to everything that Rome stood for. The triumphal entry is a clarion call for everyone that stood against the political ambitions of Rome. And it's carried out by families of ordinary people in an ordered, non-violent way.
I see now that in Jesus' time, campaigning Jews arose. But if that's true, should my bit be in poetry or prose?
Let's go for prose.
Must I?
Yeah.
Okay. The reason we know about Petronius and the Jews' campaign against evil is because a few decades after the life of Jesus, a historian called Josephus wrote a history of those times. They certainly mention Jesus, although some people think that the manuscripts were got at later in the century, so that Jesus played a bigger part in the account than Josephus intended. But most importantly, they tell us about the Jewish cultural context in which Jesus lived and died and rose again. He tells us a great deal about Pilate, which helps us understand why it was that Pilate came to the decision to have Jesus executed. And it makes that seem inevitable. But it also helps us understand why the followers of Jesus didn't simply give up when he died. He writes, "The tribe of Christians who had come in the first place to love him has not disappeared until this day." Well, that could have been written yesterday. It's resurrection by another name. Again and again, Josephus' subject is the confrontation between the Jews and the Roman authorities. He tells us that 15 years after Jesus, the Passover celebrations were, as they so often had been, a time of high tension between the Jews and the occupying power. Well, any time when a lot of people were gathered in large numbers in one place was likely to be that. The usual practice was for a cohort of Roman soldiers to be deployed on the roofs of the porticos in the temple to be ready for trouble, should it arise. Now, Josephus never writes one sentence when he could write a paragraph, and there's something rather Victorian about his style, as if he doesn't quite dare say what he means. This is him writing. One of the soldiers, raising his robe, stooped in an indecent attitude so as to turn his posterior toward the Jews and made a noise in keeping with his posture. Now, unless I've pictured this completely wrong, what Josephus is trying to say is that a Roman soldier looking down on the Jews practicing their religion turned round, mooned, and farted. The crowd took this as an appalling insult, and I have to say that I reckon it would still be shocking if it happened during the Greenbelt Communion tomorrow. So I'm not recommending it. There was a huge outcry around Jerusalem as word spread about what had happened. A very large crowd gathered, hurling either insults or stones. It's not entirely clear, but there's part of me that hopes that this was a non-violent protest. At the governor of Palestine, who by that time was a man named Cumanus. He ordered military reinforcements into the Antonia fortress, which overlooked the temple. The Jews panicked, realizing they were outnumbered and likely to be butchered, and fled. So that one was an unsuccessful protest, but at least it ended without bloodshed. But the story that's most interesting is one that Jesus would have known all about. It must have happened about the time of his baptism. Pontius Pilate brought his army from Caesarea Maritima to Jerusalem, where their winter quarters were. The military standards, which were their symbolic figureheads, a bit like each British regiment having its own flag, had the figure of the Roman Emperor on it. And at that time, it was the Roman Emperor Tiberius embossed on them. There had been an agreement that these images would not be brought into the Jews' holy city, because it was offensive to the Jews to have an image of a man who claimed to be a god, who claimed to be divine, in the vicinity of the Holy of Holies. All of Pilate's predecessors had respected this, but they didn't have the bloody-minded and bloody-handed temperament of the vicious little sadist who put Jesus to death. Pilate knew that there would be trouble, so he had the standards smuggled in under cover of night. The residents of Jerusalem found out what had happened and went to him at Caesarea to plead for him to undo what he'd done. As they travelled, they spread the news, and word of mouth multiplied in much the same way that email does in the political campaigns of today. So there was this huge flash mob by the time they reached Pilate's residence. They implored him to remove the emblems, but he refused. So what was their campaign strategy? They lay down in the street surrounding Pilate's house, and they stayed there, and they stayed there. In fact, they lay there for 5 days and nights. It was a sit-down strike. It became clear to Pilate that they were not going to go away of their own accord, so he needed to do something to break the impasse. So he invited the demonstrators to meet with him. Rather than suggesting their leaders came to see him as representatives, he invited the entire vast crowd of them to meet him for an audience in the sports stadium. What he didn't tell them was that he had hidden a huge number of his soldiers in the stadium waiting for them. On another occasion, he had his soldiers disguise themselves in Jewish-style civilian clothes with swords hidden under their cloaks, so that may have been what happened. When the Jews were gathered, expecting to negotiate, the soldiers revealed themselves, and Pilate threatened to give orders for the army to set upon the crowd unless they immediately submitted. It was a moment of great terror. And what happened next was extraordinary. One by one, the Jews got to their knees, pulled back their robes, and bared their necks on the ground next to the soldiers. Eventually, every single one of them was offering to accept martyrdom rather than tolerate the offence to the Almighty God that was taking place in Jerusalem. Suddenly, it was Pilate who was in a political dilemma instead of the Jews he'd been threatening. He had two choices: massacre an entire generation of the Jews, unarmed and unresisting, on whom the Romans relied to sustain the economy of the empire, or give in. To kill them would have been the end of his political credibility. So he gave in. It was a triumph of non-violent resistance. The evil emblems were removed, and so Jesus entered the Jerusalem in the middle of a Jewish community that knew the power of peaceful protest. But Jesus also knew how much that might have cost when it was taken to its extreme. When he said, "I haven't come to bring peace, but a sword," it may be that he knew that the road on which he was travelling was one that might mean sacrificing everything. It was a road of power and sacrifice that many generations of Christians have subsequently trodden to further the work of God's kingdom. Well, we're well into the second half of this entertainment here, and so far there have been no protests, no offers of martyrdom, no prostrate people pleading for us to stop, and no mooning and no farting, as far as I've been aware. And we're coming towards the end of our time, so if any of those things are going to happen, now's the moment. Before Nigel offers his last thoughts about why Bob and Bono and a million Christian campaigners of today are in that tradition that stretches back to James and John, Peter and Paul, we're going to offer a little interval, and we suggest that you do some thinking.
And this is what we suggest you think about. Think about all the stories you can remember from the New Testament and all of the things that Jesus said and taught. Is there anything in all of those that we've tended to treat as being about our spiritual lives and our destiny, which, within the context that they originally took place, might have an additional meaning, one that might be inspiring people to take political or campaigning action? Have a chat about it to whoever you happen to be sitting next to. Here's an example. Matthew, of course, records Jesus as saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit," a rousing bit of spiritual encouragement. But Luke says, Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor," a rousing call for political action. Different. Is there anything else that makes you think, now that I know the context, I wonder if there's more to that bit of the Bible than I first realized? And if that seems a little bit complicated, sit down, enjoy the weather, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Have a sit and a chat. I think the Holy Spirit's protesting.
Jesus said, "When two or three are gathered, I am there." Could it be this is solidarity and not about our prayer?
Do you think he really made that up in the last minute, or do you think he's used that before?
You can't beat that, but that is absolutely true, isn't it? Any other suggestions people would like to make? Not necessarily in rhyme, in any way at all.
You've intimidated.
You probably still get chocolate.
Yes, the widow's mite, the story that we all take to be an example of our generosity, that this widow's given everything she has, was actually Jesus criticising the system. The interesting thing about that story, of course, is Jesus never says the widow did the right thing. He just, and interestingly, the story's placed immediately after Jesus criticising the temple authorities for taking the last penny from the widows, and then he looks at the temple and there's the widow dropping her last penny in. This is Jesus saying the religious authorities are ripping you off as well. Yeah, political story.
Thank you. Any other thoughts?
Just thinking about the phrase, go the extra mile. I'd heard that as something about Roman soldiers being able to make them carry their bags a certain distance, but no more. So if you took the extra mile, you got them in trouble, or something like that.
Yeah, Walter Wink talks a lot about those three things, turning the other cheek, giving up your cloak, and walking the extra mile. Under Roman law, you could press gang someone into carrying your pack a mile for you if you're a soldier. You could do it anywhere in the empire. And what Jesus appears to be suggesting, or might be suggesting, is that don't carry it a mile, carry it two. Because that way your centurion then, the next person up the chain, can have a go at the soldiers. So it's a way of subverting the system, doing more than is required, that gets the soldier into trouble, not you. And Walter Winks argued that's Jesus arguing for non-violent political direct action. Great example.
So what about the business if someone wants your sweater, give them your overcoat as well?
Yes, you only had two garments, and one of them you had to retain. Because that was the thing you slept in, that was the thing that kept you warm in the fields overnight as a farmer. And what Jesus is saying this time is, if someone's trying to sue you for your shirt, go and stand in the court and take all your clothes off. Stand naked. Embarrass them. Do something different. Subvert the system. Stand up and be odd and abnormal. And that way you're kind of taking the power back. You're overthrowing what the expectation is in society. Another way of non-violent civil disobedience.
Are you recommending this?
Are you offering?
Is there anybody else? I've got some chocolates to throw. Excuse me. David, talk into the microphone.
Whilst we're on those Walter Wink examples, turning the other cheek isn't being supine. The put-down is the backhand against one cheek. You offer the other cheek and the person has to treat you as an equal and offer to punch you. And in Roman law, to punch your equals was a very serious offence.
Nigel, tell us where this leaves us all.
Well, I was going to add one more, actually. Everyone knows the story of the Gadarene demoniac, where Jesus goes up the hill and sees the individual there that's possessed and casts out the demon into the herd of swine that we hear runs over the hill and collapses down the hill and dies. Does anyone wonder why the demon is called Legion? When the Jewish people are oppressed by a Roman force that has legions, and that legion is thrown out into the animal that the Jews find religiously unclean and kills it. Is that a political protest? Should we be reading something into the fact that Jesus is casting out legion? There's also an interesting story, because apparently there were two Jews that were watching that when it happened, and one said, "Do you really think he's going to throw out the demon?" And the other one goes, "Pigs might fly."
Terrible joke, have a chocolate.
So where does that leave us? We've tried to show you that first century Palestine was rife with political protest, and that most of the protests were complex mix of religious and political issues. We've suggested that bearing that context in mind, it might be possible to reread some of the stories of Jesus as being political in nature and not simply religious. A split between the sacred and secular, of course, that didn't exist in first century Judaism anyway, and perhaps probably shouldn't exist in our faith either. But what relevance does it have for us if first century Jews were political protesters, even if Jesus was a political protester? What does it mean for our life of faith? Let's hear another very familiar passage from the New Testament and see if that says anything to us.
As Jesus passed along the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and his brother Andrew casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. And Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fish for people." And immediately they left their nest and followed him. And he went a little bit farther, and he saw James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John, who were in their boats mending their nets. Immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired men and followed him.
Well, Bob and Bono haven't come, but James and John have finally made it. We promised you them, and they're here. So what's that passage all about? It isn't an obvious passage about political campaigning. After all, it's one of the great evangelistic texts telling us that we too should be recruiting people to follow Jesus. But I also wonder if this is one of the most misunderstood passages in the church today, because I don't think it's about evangelism. I think it's about justice. The question we have to ask is, what is it that the disciples would have understood by the phrase fishers of men or fishers of people? And the best way we can do that is to look at the Bible they had, our Old Testament, and find out what it is that fishers of men do in the Old Testament. Listen to these words from Jeremiah and listen out for what it is that the fishermen do. "I am now sending for many fishermen, says the Lord, and they shall catch people. For my eyes are on all their ways. They are not hidden from my presence, nor is their iniquity hidden from my sight." In this passage, the fishermen are the people who announce judgment on those whom God has found guilty. Guilty of doing evil. Let's listen to Ezekiel. And again, let's listen to what the fishermen are doing. And let's listen to what he says about Egypt and what the Egyptians had done to God's people. He says, "I am against you, king of Egypt. I will put hooks in your jaws and make the fish of your channels stick in your scales." We hear it again in Amos. "Hear this, you cows of Bashan who are on Mount Samaria, who oppress the poor and crush the needy. The time is surely coming when they shall take you away with hooks, even the last of you with fish hooks." The fishermen in Amos are there to catch and judge people who oppress the poor. And there are other examples as well. You can find it in Habakkuk, in Zephaniah, and in other passages in Ezekiel as well. The references in the Old Testament to fishing, when they're not actually about fishing, are metaphors for God's judgment against those people who have persecuted the Israelites or done evil to God's people or disobeyed God's commandment. When we hear Jesus say to the disciples, "I will make you fish for people," we should be hearing Amos in our ears saying, "You who oppress the poor and crush the needy, the time is surely coming upon you when they shall take you away with hooks, even the last of you with fish hooks." When Jesus first calls his disciples, he calls them to join him in announcing judgment on those who persecute God's people, who crush the poor and oppress the needy. Jesus' first call is to be campaigners. So if all of this is true, if the early Jesus movement was about campaigning and protesting about injustice as a way to worship God, then what is it that Peter and I think we've learned from first century Palestine? Let me give you four things to think about. First, people of goodwill do bow to political pressure and public opinion. Petronius backed down in the face of the arguments and the commitment of the Jewish people, and he wasn't democratically elected. So we, theoretically, should stand a better chance than the people of first century Palestine. If our politicians claim they care, and they do claim they care, then let's hold them to account over it. Let's see if they really are the people of goodwill that they claim to be. Second, all sorts of pressure counts. Letter writing, mass demonstrations, petitions. These are the tactics straight out of the Christian Aid campaign handbook. And probably if you read our literature, they'll tell you we've got this exciting new idea. We learnt it only 2,000 years ago from Petronius and the Jews. And why are we still using these same techniques? Because they work. And if you don't believe me, go and ask all the children in Uganda that are in school today because of the Jubilee Debt campaign. Third, money matters. The advantage the Jews had when they confronted Petronius was they were supposed to be planting crops. No planting, no crops, no food. They had Petronius over a barrel. And in this day and age, so do you and I. We can use our money and our choices about how we spend our money to exert pressure on companies. Why is fair trade coffee everywhere now? Because you bought so much of it that it's impossible for supermarkets to ignore. They have to stock it. Why did so many supermarkets join the Ethical Trading Initiative? Because so many of you, their loyal customers, wrote to them and said, "We care about this, and they can't afford to lose your business." And those are two possibilities. What about ethical banking? Green energy? What about economic boycotts? Something that we should be careful about using, but we can on occasion. The possibilities of the ways we can use our money to exercise political influence are huge, and the potential in the future remains. Finally, and most importantly, leave your nets. Campaigning is for life, not just for Greenbelt. The disciples were asked to leave behind their financial security. Let's listen to what Mark says again. And they left their father Zebedee in a boat with the hired men and followed him. With the hired men. This was a family that was well off enough to hire staff. This was a successful family fishing business. They employed people. I think that fact alone tells us two interesting things. One, that people with financial security are called to join the struggle, which should be a relief for all of us here. James and John certainly had were comfortable. They didn't have to follow Jesus, thank you very much, but they did anyway. They were called. And secondly, he called them to leave their nets behind. He didn't ask them to take a few days off fishing. He didn't ask them to give it up for the weekend and come back to it. He didn't ask them to get some cover to fill in while they're away. He said, "Leave your nets behind and come and fish with me." I'm not suggesting that everyone here needs to give up their jobs and apply for work at Christian Aid, because if you did, I'd be out of a job. But I am suggesting that campaigning for justice is not something we do occasionally. It's not something we do in our spare time. It's something that needs to seep into our entire life and way of thinking and acting and living. The thing we need to do is to leave our nets and follow Jesus.
Believers were campaigning for the past 2,000 years. We hope this has inspired you and allayed some of your fears.
And Christian Aid can help if you feel this applies to you. We've got some forms to sign so you can join the movement too.
We'll write to you 5 times a year. We promise, not in rhyme. We'll ask you to sign postcards and send them to the Prime
Minister.
Don't look at me like that. It's flipping hard to keep this rhyming couplets business up.
The worst idea you've ever had. They're bored of you and I. These folk have sat here for an hour. It's time for them to fly.
Go off and hear a bishop or a preacher or a band, or see the tent of Christian Aid if that's what you can stand.
So if you have a question, I'm afraid our time's run out. But stop us when you see us. Just holler, scream and shout.
If you are God's campaigner, now we hope you realise why. You're in a great tradition.
Good afternoon.
Goodbye.